Welcome to Blether Together, brought to you by Farmstrong Scotland. I'm your host, Sarah Stephen, and together we'll be travelling across Scotland to chat to farmers and crofters to learn more about them, their businesses, challenges, and the positive steps they take to manage their well-being. Our thanks go to NFU Mutual Charitable Trust for supporting the podcast series and to our founding funders, Movember and the Royal Highland Agricultural Society of Scotland. This is an emotional one. Well, it certainly got me anyway. Callum and wife Zara moved to Arran to start a new life in 2023. What happened 5 months later transformed their lives forever. Callum's recovery has been incredibly difficult and challenging, but he says he just takes it day by day. I'll let self-described cheeky chappy Callum Lindsay explain more. Good morning, Callum. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to come and share my story and hopefully increase people's mental mindset and well-being. And hope that the journey that Farmstrong has fallen through with is used to its potential.
Yeah, no, it's nice to be part of it. Now you're coming to us live from the Isle of Arran. What does it look like on the Isle of Arran today?
Today, well, it's probably our 3 days of summer. You know, it's been dry and it's not raining the last 2 days, so it's maybe summer. Maybe that's the pre-lambing weather over and done with.
Yeah, that's it. We've got to make the most of it while we can. So what's your morning look like so far?
I'm a upland farmer on the island of Arran. We're running Galloway cows and hill yows, and we're just in the middle of calving. So this morning we were looking for a cow that we thought had calved to discover that one of the cows had actually had twins. A nice sunny morning looking for a calf on a hill. It's been quite good.
Have you had a good strong cup of tea or coffee yet?
I always like to start the morning with a good cup of coffee or maybe two.
You're a man after my own heart. I can't do anything until I have my coffee, Callum. Right, so normally I'm starting these podcasts with a little bit of a quick fire question round. Are you up for that? Are you open to answering some questions? We're going to dive deep.
Go on.
It's all pretty surface sort of questions. Right, Callum, I'll fire away, okay? So just one word answer is the first thing that pops into your head. Go for it, okay?
Yep.
Right, we'll start. Sun or snow?
Sun.
Nickname your parents or friends used to call you?
Milky.
How long does it take you to get ready?
A minute.
First celebrity crush?
I don't know.
Who's on your wall as a kid? As in, which poster did you have on your wall as a kid?
I kind of see Adam Henson. I would sound a bit different, wouldn't I?
We welcome our broad church here. Do you snore?
I don't, but the wife says I do.
What's for dinner tonight?
Mince and tatties.
What's the fastest speed you have driven a car?
140.
Are you politically correct?
No.
Do you believe in love at first sight?
Yes.
Would you go to a movie alone?
Yes.
What's your middle name?
Don't have one.
There you go. See, easy. We know more about you already. Well, I'm quite interested in at the speed that you drove the car at.
It was at Knockhill Racecourse.
Oh, okay, good. So I wasn't on the public roads. So you covered yourself there. And you do know what's for dinner tonight, which I think is pretty good at this time in the morning.
I defrosted it this morning, so hi.
Great. Callum, you're not a native to the Isle of Arran. So what took you there? And tell us a bit about how you got to the island.
I moved to the island of Arran from my family farm in Stirlingshire. I was farming with my mum, my dad, my brother, my grandparents when they were alive, and a very close family friend passed away that I thought of as an auntie. She gave me the opportunity to come to Arran to take over Hillside Farm, which is in the south end of the island. It's not a big farm, but it gave me, my wife and my two kids the opportunity to start farming on our own right. We came here full-time in May 2 years ago, and during the year before we started moving over from the mainland, over a year, kind of coming over and doing things after the passing of Anne, and we got the opportunity to rent the in-by ground and the in-by hill and a farm along the road. As the year progressed on, had a kind of catch-up meeting with the factor and the landlord, and they gave us the opportunity to rent the entire hill, which hadn't been farmed since Chernobyl, so there hadn't been stock on it for over 30 years. Which gave us the opportunity to expand into large-scale upland hill farming. So we're now, the hill's about 5,000 acres.
Fantastic. Can I ask, Callum, just to go back a step, Callum, at home, was there an opportunity at home as well? Or is it because, obviously, you mentioned your brother. So what was the dynamic there?
So Easter Froo is 150 acres. It just gave us the opportunity to both expand. You know, there was a lot of rented ground and there was cows and my father's got a haulage business. But prior to that, when I left school, I went to New Zealand and Norway shearing. So I had a career shearing for a good number of years. And then I had an accident where I tore out my ACL and MCL in my knee, which kind of restricted my full-time shearing.
Could you share how you did that?
Yeah. I shot an in-calf cow behind a gate and the gate came off its hinges, landed on top of my leg. The cow had a wee rollabout on top of me. I stupidly took my gilly off with my phone in it at the other end of the shed. So I had to get out from the gate, pull myself through the barrier, and get my phone. My mother was away, my wife was working, my brother and father were away driving, so I was at home on my own. Phoned my father, and he phoned the neighbour. The neighbour came up and switched off the diet wagon, the tractors and that, because I thought, just nip in, jag that cow, get it done, keep going. And off I went, in the ambulance and ended up knee reconstruction. And yeah, it was a kind of slow recovery. I ended up with a knee infection after the surgery and prolonged the healing factor.
These accidents, though, aren't they, the very familiar stories, you know, across the sort of industry? It's the blink of an eye, isn't it?
I feel that everybody's in the mental mindset that it's not going to happen to me. Ugh, these things happen, but it's not going to happen to me. If people can change the way they look at things, can actually reduce the outcome of these accidents. You know, if I'd said, oh, well, that's fine, I'll stick my phone in my pocket when I take my jacket off. I'm not saying the gate wasn't going to come off its hinges and the cow wasn't going to land on my knee. That wasn't not going to happen. You know, that accident happened. But if you're working on your own, you really need to think of a way of communication. It's quite key, especially when you're working on your own, as long as you're in a situation, especially for a mental factor, you've got the ability to phone for help.
And that's a massive physical injury to you. You know, recovery, it sounds like it took a long time to recover from that physically. Did it take a toll on you sort of emotionally and mentally?
That didn't really bother me. I wasn't really up nor down. A couple of years after that, I sustained a high-pressure oil injection into my hand, where I lost the feeling, well, partial feeling in my hands. Half of it came back. So that affected me more than anything. You know, I thought, oh, I can't feel my hand anymore, you know. And that annoyed me a wee bit, you know, that like if you were in the workshop and you were welding something and you picked up and it was hot, you thought, I don't know if I've burnt myself or not, you know. And it was things that was out of your control, which left you feeling uncomfortable, but you couldn't do anything about it. You know, that mentally annoyed me more. I wouldn't say that it upset me. It was more mentally frustrating.
But you're glass half full, glass half empty sort of person anyway. What was the, when we talk about the dynamic in your family, or just reflecting on that, what was the environment that you grew up in? Was it a sort of can-do, go out there into the world, go get them sort of sons and see what happens?
My father specifically, you know, he was very encouraging to get me and my brother both heavily involved and give us a lot of responsibility.
Did you want to farm?
I've always wanted to farm ever since I was a wee boy. I had a notion, you know, that I was going to be an auctioneer, and I'd done the school work experience and went to United Auctions. We got back to school and everybody's on about, I got £50 for my week's work experience. Oh, I got a gift voucher and blah, blah, blah. I got sent home with the outstanding bill for the float washing that I hadn't been paid.
Sounds like a typical father. Mm-hmm.
I never pursued my career as an auctioneer, and I wasn't very academically blessed at school. And this vision that I was going to go to agricultural college and quite the keen interest dealer, go to Harper Adams or Green Mountain, Northern Ireland. I didn't get the grades, and I was always quite keen. And I was always very, very keen in sheep. I got an opportunity, I'd start when I left school, I took a summer job shearing down in the borders. I got offered an opportunity to go to Norway to shear in the freezing works in Norway. As my father said, well, I was just 17. My father says, wild horses wouldn't stop me. You know, I was setting this, I was going, I was really, really keen to get out there. And then when I was in Norway, I applied for a working visa and then went on to work. The first year I worked in the South Island in New Zealand, went enrolled in a shearing course over there and went to New Zealand thinking that I could shear a sheep and came back realising that I wasn't that great. And then I decided when I was in New Zealand, instead of working for somebody, I was going to start my own shearing run. I was going to become a contractor. So
sorry to interject, Callum. Do you regret not applying yourself more at school? Because I'm sure you're more than capable.
Not the slightest.
No.
Not in the slightest. I think a lot of young people are pressured into thinking that everything runs round about being academically paper certificated, and it's most definitely not the case. A higher in English, yeah, it might help me fill out a form a wee bit better, and it's good that the wife's got higher English and that she's a wee bit more literate than me. But I'm very dyslexic and I've never let it hold me back.
Do you have the same philosophy with your own children?
Yes, I'm a great believer as long as they're fit and healthy and they're polite and well-mannered and they behave, they'll get on absolutely fine.
So you sort of cut your teeth the hard way, you did it in a roundabout way, and you find yourself back at home and working with your brother, and potentially that's not a long-term solution, is it? I mean, I suppose a lot of these things with the dynamics of a family and there's brothers and dads still involved and parents still involved, that it didn't sound like that was a long-term solution to stay there.
It was always, you know, it was always the plan that, you know, we would expand with the harder things in agriculture. You know, the room and the price of land in the Central Belt was just didn't financially add up. You know, we got the opportunity for me to come to Arran on my own accord and start on our own. I had a couple of bits of rented ground that I had along with the home farm that I had a handful of sheep and some cows. You know, we had 10 cows and 100 sheep. The cows came home and they went back to the home farm in the winter, and we calved them there and then put them out to grazing.
It's a topic that comes up a lot in this podcast, is sort of sometimes things come out that sort of would work in terms of family dynamics and relationships, and not everybody had, some people have a great relationship with their family and it's all gone very well. I mean, do you have a good relationship with your dad, your mum, your brother, your family? Has that all been quite plain sailing?
Yeah, I've always had a great relationship with my parents. There was always a bit of frustration between me and my brother, you know. And it was more probably, it wasn't, you know, we didn't go on, we actually worked quite well together, but we were all really, really busy, you know. He was away driving full time and he's coming home and he's thinking of things that he'd done the more kind of arable side, you know, he'd done spraying fertiliser on and tractor work and that. But he would have it in his head of an idea of what he thought was needing done. But you're going, oh, we're in the guts of calving hundreds of cows here, and I'm thinking about, you know, get that rolled and get some fertiliser lashed on, we'll get the cows out. It built for maybe not the most pleasurable and happy working environment at times. But in general, you know, we all got on really, really well and we all worked really well together. You know, you would have your fallouts and that and a screaming match or two. But I think in a working environment, if you don't voice your opinion, you're only building for that mental depression of that you're holding it in. You're far better to open up, speak about it, you know, don't hold it in. At the end of the day, you might upset somebody else's feelings, but they know where you are and where you stand, and then you can work on the change to come to the outcome of it, you know, and work on to a better relationship. And it's 9 times out of 10 everybody's thinking the same thing, but everybody's got a different opinion, and you can work to sort that problem. It's where if everybody bottles it all up, never says, that problem just keeps rolling on and rolling on, and then you've got another problem and it snowballs and it falls into an out of control, unhappy environment that you can't resolve.
Do you feel you've got quite a clear vision of, you know, this, I suppose, what's going to happen in the future, the succession, the family, everything's quite clear to you what's going to be further down the line?
Yeah, it's a wee bit uncertain. The girls are still quite young, you know, they're 3 and 6. You know, if they're interested in agriculture, that's great. Absolutely tremendous. I'm not going to force it upon them in any way, manner, or mean. But if they want to come and take it over, I'm all there behind them all the way. And I'll do everything that I can to make sure the two of them are equal. My grandfather always was there, the opportunity for my father, and they worked very well together. And then me and my twin brother, mother and father always made sure that there was equal opportunity there for us. My dad and my brother, they're farming away in the mainland. I'm here. I would never have came to Hillside, but I wouldn't have got the volume of agricultural opportunity on the mainland compared to where I am now, which is, you know, it's been a big mental relief. And, you know, we are fulfilling. I always wanted to be an upland farmer, so I'm fulfilling my dream of working on hill ground. And sometimes I wish I was back in the Carse of Stirling with lush green fields of grass right enough. And
the grass is always greener.
Only got 5 bales to the acre off of that horrible little unby field. Could have been getting 12 in the Carse of Stirling.
There's no doubt that I know that part of the world well, and I know a lot of farmers in that part of the world and down that sort of peninsula. But, you know, it's tougher. Do you think it's tougher to farm on an island?
Most definitely, yeah. You know, everything relies on the ferry. It doesn't matter whether it's a stamp for the post office or it's a ton of cake. It's all got to come in on the boat. every lamb or every calf or every litre of milk that's produced on the island all has to go back off on the boat. So if the boat doesn't sail for a couple of days and you're needing something, everything's relying on the boat. When's the boat coming back? What's the weather going to be? We would have liked to have had lime on by now, but we couldn't get here, you know, because all winter we fight with the weather. And then all spring and all summer we fight with the overbooking of tourism.
I was going to say, it's a popular island, so you probably can't move in the summer.
Due to the ongoing ferry snaggle, the tourist rate on the island has dropped. It's a shame for the economy of the island, but it's a wee bit more peaceful when you're not running between two farms and you have to pass 100 cyclists.
Another islander I spoke to fairly recently, not that long ago, was Rob Wainwright, who lives on the island of Col. And he sort of described, you know, he's been there for a long time. You know, he's raised his family there. And just the highs and lows of the ferry going or not going and how that really impacted their morale. And everybody wanted to get off the island to go and see a movie and they couldn't do it. I don't mean to be flippant about it, but it can affect your mood. And, you know, if you're stuck there for another week and you can't get what you need and you just don't get that sort of interaction with, inverted commas, civilization, it can have a big impact.
You know, it's like in the summer that annoys me and it kind of gets me a wee bit. When you're really busy and then you get a quiet day and you go, oh, I would love to do something with the kids. Now, there is, the island is full of beautiful things to do. There's walks and there's a castle and there's this, that and the next thing. Lovely place to come. But when you live here, it becomes normality. You think, oh, I'll take them to the science centre or something. But you're rushing away for the first boat in the morning. Your normal jobs to do, you know, dogs to feed, cattle check, sheep to make sure they're upright. So you're up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and then you're rushing in, you get a shower and you dash for the boat. The first boat used to leave at 8:20 and it went to Drossensuja. 9:30, you're 10:30, 11 o'clock before you're anywhere. And then you really had to be leaving there at 3 o'clock to get back to the 6 o'clock boat home. So you're going, that's fine, your day away, you've spent half of it travelling and sitting on the boat and you're going, fine, that's fine. Sorry kids, you've seen half the science centre, we're away back for the boat. Or you would go, oh, we'll do something. Oh, well, that's 9 o'clock. Oh, by the time we get the boat, we'll not get home the day. We need to stay somewhere. Oh, we'll go up to Granny and Grandpa's. And the time you go there, and then you go, oh, but we've got that to do. We need to get on and get them lambs jagged. You just don't.
Work creeps back in because you live and work in the same place. So it's too easy just to go out and do things that you need to do.
And I think the longer that we're here, the more that we just say, right, we're going. You know, you've just got to. And a very good friend of mine from Uist, when he heard we were moving, he phoned and he says, I'm going to phone you once a week. I says, all right, okay, very good, Alec. That's great, thanks. I thought, I'll hear for you once a month. And he says, I'm going to phone you every week. And he says, I'm going to make sure that you're going off island once a month. I says, why? He says, because he says, for a mental factor, you're fine. But he says, you need to get the wife away. Even if she's just going to Tesco's or to do a big food shop, she's getting off. Before, up until now, Zara was looking after the kids because Lucy's just started nursery. She wasn't getting out and about. And I think she found it harder moving than I did because I'm away along the road and you're bumping into folk. But I felt that she felt a bit lonely. You know, now she's got a job and she's meeting people and she's seeing different folk every day. You know, I think she's a lot happier. It's good, you know.
That's really lovely to hear you share that, Callum, because I'm sure there's lots of women out there that are married to farmers, potentially in a similar situation, that are raising children at a very young age and feel the same. So it's nice that you're very much aware of what she was feeling and very much in tune with that.
I always remember my father's friend emigrated to Canada. We went to visit them. We were over on holiday when I was wee with my father, and he came in and he saw around about the farm. And I can always remember asking him, are you happy here? And he said, yeah, well, kind of, but that there's my company. And I looked over into the back of his pickup and there's a wee Jack Russell dog. He says, that's the only thing I've seen and spoke to for the last 3 weeks because I'm working through the night. So he says, everybody's sleeping that you could talk to. He says, the wife's up through the day, she's sleeping at night. So he says, I'm not talking to her. And their kids were at the age that they were going away to uni and that. And she was at home looking after the cattle through the day. And she just looked so miserable. She was a real lovely person. She was very welcoming. I didn't know her, but she just looked so unhappy. I remember, and she said, oh, it's all right. He goes to the sale yards and he sees the cattle sell and he blathers to this person. He goes to the feed store and he gets corn and blah, blah, blah. I go to the shops for the groceries, push the trolley around about, but I don't know any of them.
That's really stuck with you. You're obviously a very strong team with your wife. So it sounds like you're a good, strong team.
Oh, you know, she's my permanent carer, you know, so.
I'm keen to know, does Alec phone every week?
Like,
oh, he's a good guy then. He's a good friend. Shout out to Alec.
Alec McCaskill.
Alec McCaskill on US. You sound like a good man. So well done you for phoning. And does he always phone you or do you phone him?
Both.
Good.
He's quite good at keeping an eye on me.
So island life with its ups and its downs, its highs and its lows, it's the ferry, whether or not it sails or not. It sounds like you've got a good setup there. It sounds like you're known in the island. You're part of a community. But I know it hasn't all been, excuse the metaphor, plain sailing. You've had some trials and tribulations, Callum, on the island.
Yeah, about 18 months ago, I had an ATV accident where I came off the bike on the hill. It's related to a C1, C2 fracture and fracturing my nasal socket round about between my eyes, which I was airlifted off. And then I was home after with a brace on. And once the swelling went down, the inside of my nose fell out. So the cartilage had detached in my nose socket, which I had to go back, get my nose packed. They put in things called nasal rhinals, which is maybe not the most politically way of describing them, but they're like a large tampon. So they ram them up your nose into the back of your throat and then they blow them up with air. They do that when they can't get it to stop bleeding. They poke the inside of my nose back in and then they packed them with them. And then I was shipped back off to Crosshouse to get the whole inside of my nose right back to my throat cauterised and the inside of my nose attached back in. We started off on the recovery journey.
So a normal day, you're out on the quad bike. I mean, you're giving me the heebie-jeebies the way you describe that recovery and what you did to yourself. That normal morning, that normal day, you're out on your bike. What can you remember? Can you just give us a sort of summary of what you can remember?
Yeah, it was a wild kind of day. You know, it was horrible. The boats had already been pre-cancelled due to the adverse weather conditions. I says, oh, I'll go for a run along the road. Cows were all tied up at home. Everything was done. And then by sheep were checked here. And I says, run along the road and have a look. I got half along the road and I said, I think I'll just go and get a coffee out of the co-op in the Scottish Farmer. I'll hide in the pickup for an hour until Zara checked the sheep. That's wet and horrible out there. And dundered round to the co-op, got my Costa coffee and read the paper. And I thought, we run along the side of the road that crosses the middle of the island. I stopped and I had a look with the binoculars. It's a bit of a burn that runs down into a kind of waterfall. And I seen it with the binoculars. It's kind of sheep stuck there and we'd better go out and check them. So I went in and there was boys at the farm, the estate's used for a lot of deer stalking. Seen them and they're like, ah, we're not going to go out today. The guests aren't wanting to go out. It's all right, okay, no worries. So go out and check these sheep. So I headed away out. It's wet windy out here. I had the four dogs with me and seen the sheep and the dogs out both sides. And if I was going any slower, I would have been stopped. And I can remember hitting, I thought I was on the hill track, but because the overgrown spread of bracken just covering everything, it's a real big problem in upland farm at the moment, but that's a different story. So I hadn't seen this stone. I thought, back down on the hill track, I'm just a wee bit off it. And I remember hitting the stone with the bike. And the last thing I remember was hitting the front rack. I remember coming over the handlebars and hitting the front rack. But it happened in split seconds. But it felt so long. I can remember feeling my whole body throwing forward and hitting the front rack. I don't remember hitting the ground, but I remember feeling hitting the ground, but I don't remember hitting the ground. Both dogs were out. They're working away and sheep had started to cross up behind the waterfall and they're going round. But, you know, the dogs were well out. You know, we're very lucky to be blessed that we've got good working dogs. I remember when I came back round, I'd obviously knocked myself unconscious. I came back round, I went, I'm roasting. And I put my hand down. I remember touching my face and going, Christ, that's sore. I was covered in blood. It had been running. It didn't look like I was covered in blood, but when I put my hand down the inside of my shirt, it was just a sea of congealed blood everywhere because I'd been hosing out my nose and my mouth. The dogs were all back beside me. They were all beside me. And I thought, there's a young dog and an old dog that don't really go on. They hate each other. So they're always working opposite sides. And I looked round about and I gave them a whistle and they all got on the bike. And I went, that's quite positive. They must know there's something wrong.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know the extent of how I'd hurt myself. I knew I'd hurt myself, but I was out and about the hill. It was quite far out. You know, I was over a few miles out. No phone signal. So I got my phone out and I looked at it. No phone signal.
Were you lying down at this point? Were you trying to sit up or were you completely...
I was lying on my side. It was like at that point, I'd rolled over onto my side and I knew I'd really hurt myself, but I didn't know how badly I'd hurt myself. You know, I thought at that point, I thought I'd broke my nose and I was a wee bit sore. I thought, what am I going to do here? Have I rolled the bike? I wasn't aware whether what I'd done at that point. And I looked around about, the bike's still sitting upright, running. Just, here we go. So sprackled onto the bike, got up onto the bike. I thought, what am I going to do? Like, I've came off. But I don't know, at that point, you know, I was unaware of why I'd came off it.
Well, adrenaline's going through you. You just, yeah, it's fight or flight, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I got back off the bike and I thought, all right, okay. This pathetic wee stone had catapulted me off the bike. You know, I can't even say it was a big stone, you know. It's a pathetic wee stone. But I'd been going that slow that I'd hit in between the front wheels and that was me. I was stopped. I thought, what will I do? So I made back on. The sheep had all crossed over. We'd surf what we were out there to do. The dogs had done well. Headed back in and I got halfway back in and I went, I'm going to be sick. Can't be sick. I knew at that point I was really hurt myself quite badly. And I went, like, if I'm sick, the adrenaline will pass, you know, can that, your body will throw out. So I'd got down, I could see the stain, and I went, I can't have phone signal been out. And I phoned Zara, I says, I've hurt myself, it'll need to come. And she says, very good, you know, ha ha, you know, don't cry wolf. You know, because I'm quite bad, for, I've hurt myself, but I've maybe cut my finger, you know, but very good, you know, right? She says, if you're needing, what have you done, you know? I says, no, I says, I hurt myself, but I don't know how bad it is. And she said, right, I'm on my way, you know, because usually I'm going, oh, I've cut myself and it's a 6-inch gash and my finger's hanging off. I says, I don't know. I says, I've hurt myself, you'll need to come and get me. All I could hear was her shouting, get in the car, girls, you know, get in the car. So I knew she was on her way and I lost phone signal by that point. And I got down to the stead and in the back door of the pickup was still lying open at the hill shed. I looked around about and the dogs had all bailed off. They were standing on the back door of the pickup. And the old dog always needs a lift in the pickup, but he was standing in the back door. I was like, right, dogs know there's something wrong. So I put the bike in the shed and I got back and I got into the pickup and I thought, I'm going to drive to the hospital. I'm just going to drive to the hospital. I couldn't work the keys. It was asking me to unlock the door. I'm sitting in the pickup. But I was pushing the wrong button. I was trying to start it with the hazard lights. I got out of the pickup and I walked down the road and Zara got me into the car. Well, we went down to the local hospital on the island. There only is the one. It's a kind of cottage hospital. They've got the basic facilities, provide a great service to the island. You can treat heart attacks and things like that. You know, basic, you broke your arm, plaster up, stick a stookie on it, and away you go. Gets round to the hospital. I can remember she dropped me at the front door and I got out. And she said, I'll give you a hand. Just sit there. And I got out and I sprackled in my shitey waterproofs and covered in blood, and I walked in the door. This wee cleaner auxiliary, she's coming towards me. She says, are you okay? I says, I'm fab. I'm looking for a doctor. And the doctor just happened to be, you know, because it's a small hospital and they've got all things to happen to be, he was there. And I didn't know him at that given time. Lovely guy. I can still hear him yet. Just that lead, there only is 2 bays in accident emergency. It's just a wee hospital. Pull that woman out that's tripped. We can deal with her. Just wheel her down the corridor a bit, clear a bay, bring another bed, and put the helicopter up. He says, here we go. You know, he looked at me and knew that they would need to get me to the mainland, so they've got me onto a bed. And I can still say, right, we're going to take your wellies off now, Callum. I says, that's fine. I said, just let me know when you're going to pull. No, we're not going to pull them. We're just going to cut them off. I says, you can't cut them off. I says, I've only had them a week. I says, they're £110. Can't be cutting them off. I says, never mind the waterproofs. I says, they're good ones. So he went to pull it away. I said, just cut them off. I says, that's sore. So they cut them off and they radioed back over or phoned back to say that the small air ambulance had tried to come over. But because of the adverse weather and the wind was so strong that they had had to back route, they weren't coming. So we said, we're going to try the Coast Guard, but if they can't land, you need to go out by lifeboat. So the lifeboat on the island is a 35-foot rib. The Cali Isles was still here at the time. And I'm going, if the Cali Isles can't sail, there's no chance I'm going out in a rib. Not even maybe. They managed to get the Coast Guard landed on their 6th or 7th attempt. They transferred me over. And the guys in the air ambulance, they were great value. Real good guys, providing an outstanding life-saving service to remote communities in situations where people are in desperate need of help. The pressure had got that much on the flight over, so it's usually it's a 14-minute chopper ride from Arran to Cross House, but it was taking them so much longer because they were fighting against the turbulence going over. I can remember I'm lying there and I'm going, this is bad. My head's throbbing. Felt like it was going to burst. They're all blocked and strapped up. And I says, can't do this anymore. And he's busy with his paperwork. I could just see it at the corner of my eyes, filling out forms and getting ready for the hospital. I've got my hand, they had me in a medevac bag, which they put you in, they vacuum out, and it goes hard so you can't move. And I'd managed to get my hand out, and I pushed the head blocks away. The relief of pressure was unreal. You know, I'm thinking, oh, I just can't do any more of this. You know, if this is what it's going to be like, I'd much rather just, that would be the end of it, you know. So I got the blocks off, and he says, you've done really well. We've been up for 27 minutes. You've done really well. You've stayed really still until you've pushed your head support off. He says, but I'll leave it off until we get to the hospital. Promise to stay still. It's because your face is kind of went blue with the pressure. I says, yeah, yeah. So he gave me a headset just lying next to me. And he says, yeah, we're just waiting on clearance to divert to Belfast because the turbulence will take us in the Belfast direction. And it's not much. As far as the crow flies, we were just as close to that point. He says, can't take me to Belfast. Oh, he says, what's wrong with Belfast? I says, I've only got a tenner in my pocket. How am I going to get home? You know, and he made great humour out of that situation, you know, and that really helped. And I think people have got to remember, I could have been lying there going, I'm going to die. And I can always, you know, they were putting me in the helicopter and his colleague had said, I think you should speak to your wife, you know, you should say goodbye. She can't come with you. You should say goodbye to her. I says, I can't. I says, it'll be all right, buddy. I says, only the good die young. So I says, let's go. And he says, you've got to maintain that attitude. He says, you've just got to keep going as positive as that. Going to Cross House and they done organ x-rays and scans and that. And they said, look, we're not two fractures in C1 and C2. And you're fractured round about your nose socket. Your nose is quite mushy, but he says, the swelling's holding it in place. We can't do anything for your nose, he says, until the swelling goes down. Was it broken before? I says, yeah, it's been broken a few times. This is probably talking when I should have been listening. You have the option. We'll do follow-up scans on your neck. But he says, we could pin it at the moment, but we don't want to pin it at the moment because it's hairlined on both sides. If it was right through, we would prep for theatre and pin it just now. So they decided they didn't pin it. So I wore a brace that went right down my back for 6 months.
I find that very emotional, Callum. I'm sorry. I'm just thinking about what you were thinking and your family and your wife and your children. And I find that very difficult to listen to because I can't imagine the worry that they had and what was going through your head. And you just sounded like you just coped so well. It makes me feel...
Zara was very worried. And
I just can't even imagine what was going through your head or just, well, you've explained it. But... And I'm looking at the date. Well, I've got some notes here. And I'm looking at the date going, that's October 2023. That is 18 months ago that happened.
Yeah.
It's nothing really. And I mean, in terms of recovery, you look very well. What's it been like?
The recovery has been difficult. You know, once I got home, I was wearing a brace and then we went back and we had the inside of my nose reconstructed and we're home. Kind of really started the recovery period. There was quite a high suspicion that I had damaged my pituitary gland, brain organ, which controls a lot of hormones and that. So I'm like a racehorse in the Grand National. I'm peeing every 5 minutes. And I was up and down to the toilet through the night like a greyhound runner in a race course. It was never ending. Spoke to the doctor and he says, you know, you've sustained a serious amount of brain bruising and slow recovery. And you shouldn't be watching telly. You shouldn't be on your phone. He says, because he says, you know, he says, you should just be sitting. He says, read a book for 2 minutes in the morning, 2 minutes at night. That's it. He says, and then the rest of the time you have just to relax, you know, have a sleep, get up, have a cup of tea, don't try and not drink caffeine, try and not drink fizzy juice, you know, water, maybe have a decaf tea, you know, start thinking about eating healthy. He says, because you've went from a very active, full out working long hours, sitting in house, he says, you're going to balloon. You know, he says, your body's used to using all that energy. He says, you're guilty, you're sitting in the house, you're going to go, have a pack of crisps, I'll have a wee chalky becky. And yeah, I did, you know, I did put on quite a bit of weight, and a lot of that was down to, you know, the unbalance of the cortisone levels that they discovered, you know. So now we went on to a cortisone tablet and we both came off it now, and you know, we're going for regular blood tests and that. But along with the recovery, you know, and it's a kind of head injury side effect, is that you become quite crabbit, you know. It's, and I was very unaware of it. I was never aggressive, you know, but I'd become grumpy, you know, and I'd kind of snap a wee bit. I felt that was harder for Zara to understand. I'm getting crabby and I'm getting grumpy, and then I go, oh, all right, okay. And it was like, she would ask me to do something and I would answer it, but I was unaware. I wasn't acknowledging everything. Although Zara was heavily involved, you know, I would always say, right, okay, right, you run down there and check the hogs, and you'll need to take two buckets there, and you'll need to go there, and you'll need this. But I've bumped my head, and I'm going, you'll need to go out the Glaister side of the hill, and if you go up to the stone and cross the burn there, but where did I cross the burn? Because you always do that. And I'm going, oh, if you go out there and you go up past, there's a stone that's actually, it's Callum's stone, because that's what it translates to in Gaelic, so it's quite fitting. So you go up round back of Callum's stone, I says, and go down and cross the burn. She came back, and I said, did you get them buckets out? I got there, and there was buckets out everywhere out there. I said, nah, definitely, I've not been out there. There's no buckets out there. And yeah, that's fine. So she had kind of stacked them out in the hill so she didn't need to take them back when they were done. I says, right. I says, you'll need to go out to Nan. I says, there's no buckets out there. She says, how many tons of buckets did you order? I says, oh, there's 6 tons of buckets. She says, well, there's only a ton in the shed. I had all these buckets out scattered everywhere in the hill. But I had no recollection of putting them out. You know, and I'm going, definitely need to. Well, tups in, and then we're coming round to lambing time, and it was getting a wee bit better, and I'm going, need organised feeding, but your feeding's here, your feeding's arrived. And I was, you know, I wasn't a goldfish, I wasn't brain damaged, but my memory, give me an hour and I'd kind of figured out. That really mentally frustrated me. You know, we weren't relatively long here, you know, and it's happened, and you're trying to build stock numbers, and you're trying to move on and create your own adventure, and you're renting other ground, and you're thinking, how can you improve it? And you're going, oh, I said I would fix that fence when it's part of the agreement. And you go, oh, can I fix the fence? And then we had a real, real bad luck. We didn't have a great scanning, you know, because there was a lot of yows pushed out to the hill that were new to the area. I knew it wasn't going to be a great scanner, but I didn't just quite expect to be as bad as that. And then we started lambing, and I wasn't really fit to do anything. The ravens are killing the lambs, and the seagull appeared, and you know, we lost 65% of our lamb crop. You know, it's catastrophically devastating. When will this year just stop kicking me? You know, there was a very good friend of mine was depressed, really badly depressed. And he had been to the doctor and he had been sectioned. And he says, the only thing that worked for him was he takes a picture every day. Think of something. He says, whether it's a calf born, just take a picture. First lamb, picture. Harrow that field, picture. And he says, you just take your phone out when you're feeling down and you look back and you say, this time last year, there was less grass. That was a good calf, but that's a better calf I've had this year. And he says, you can look back and you think that you're not getting anywhere and you go, we never had that done and that. We hadn't fixed that. Oh, look, we fixed that fence. And well, look how bad that workshop looked before we put the door on it. And that's what kept me going.
Amazing advice.
Every day I take a picture now. Whether it's a horrible, wet, rainy day, I'll take a picture of the dogs in the byre. Or I'll take a picture of a sheep lying at the burn site. You know, every day, take a picture. And when you're feeling down, you look back at them pictures. I took quite a few pictures out through my recovery. Sometimes it was just a picture from the bedroom window. I would look back at them and go, oh, well, it was raining yesterday and the day before, but it's a dry day today. Oh, well, you know.
Celebrate the small things. I mean, in terms of your road to recovery, it sounds like it's been very up and down and long. And I know you appreciate you might still have a bit to go. How do you feel where you are at the moment? If you had a sort of scale of 0 to 10, where do you feel in that scale?
You know, if 0's down low, I think, you know, we're sitting about a 7. You know, I've accepted I'm never going to be the same again. Physically, I've sustained quite a bit of damage. You know, that's never going to fully recover. You know, this is the new normal. Mentally, you know, I'm back to where I was. You know, I'm very positive, and I always had a very strong interest in bull riding and that. And he's now retired. He was a young fella. He's almost 40 now, but he's not that, you know, as far as people are concerned, he's not that old. JB Mooney's his name. Tremendous athlete. And I remember watching a clip of him at the Calgary Stampede. He had won the Stampede, but he won it with a broken pelvis. He said that pain is only a mental factor. If you tell yourself it's sore, you will believe it's sorer than it is. If you tell yourself it's not sore, you will outcome it. If you keep telling yourself that you're okay, you will be fine. It's mind over matter. And a lot of my recovery, you know, I would wake up and I was sore. You know, I'm not a great one for, I'm not a sympathy looker. You know, I just like to get up and go on as much as I can. But I knew I wasn't fit to. And I always kept telling myself, it's mind over matter. You can do it. And just do a wee bit more at a time. Whether it's defrost mints for the ties at night, you know, or go and stick the plug in the bath and do that yourself, or fold some washing for Zara. Take the dogs for a walk. Go and give the dog a muck out. Or, you know, it was the wee things. And they were the things that pushed me on, and I'm very lucky. I had a lot of great family support and that behind me, and tremendous neighbours on the island that were very good and very helpful. But the reality is, you've got to try and keep a positive mindset even when you feel low.
It must have completely transformed the way you see the world, you see life, you see what's next, everything that you do.
Yeah, I wasn't wearing a helmet when I had my accident. And, you know, I've became very strongly opinionated about wearing helmets. And we've done our wee bit with the RSABI, their helmet safety awareness campaign. And now, as a mental wellbeing mindset, I feel more safe on a bike now with a helmet than I ever did without one. The factor of when I started wearing a helmet, I thought, this is the most hellish thing that man has ever created. This is not going to work. Now I'm wearing it, you know, and it's like when the rule came out that you wore seatbelts, everybody burst out laughing and went, I'll never get that. That's never going to work. If you can change that mental mindset, they've passed that generation. Like, the kids don't get in the car, the kids automatically put their seatbelt on because the generation before them are doing it now. So, you know, so the trend's been broken. So that's a mental mindset that you just get in, you put your seatbelt on. The change to thinking that it would be a mental mindset that you just got on a bike, put your helmet on, is possible, but it's changing people's perception of safety. I'm not saying that you're going to outrule accidents on bikes. There's always going to be accidents on bikes on farms, regardless whether you're wearing a helmet or not. But the outcome could be far more better if you had a helmet on. You know, you stick your helmet on, it's less than 5 seconds. Just stick it on.
Well said, Callum. And I think, you know, sometimes like towards the end of the podcast, I ask people what they do on a daily basis that makes them feel good. And is it physical? Do they go out and have a run, or do they go to the gym, or do they have a glass of wine? But you are living the life that as much as you can at the moment. And you are a massive advocate for just taking it a day as it comes and doing what you can on each day. And even if it's one positive thing by taking a photo. The gym can wait, and you know, the glass of wine might be there at the end of the day anyway, but what a truly inspirational story. It's just, you had me on the edge of the seat. I just couldn't believe what was happening and how you've remembered every single element of it. It's inspiring, Callum. Thank you very much for sharing that.
No, thank you very much for listening. You
know, when we first spoke, I was thinking, oh, well, you've done your MCL and your ACL, okay, and you put something in your hand, okay, right, what... You know, I appreciate you might have a long way to go in terms of recovery and physically and mentally. You're dealing with challenges every day, but it sounds like you have a fantastic support around you with Zara and your girls and your family on the mainland. And you have a very positive outlook as much as you can. We all have our ups and downs, but you're doing your best to make it work for you.
Oh, you've just got to try and maintain as much positivity as you can. And if you see somebody that you think is feeling a bit down, just don't speak to them. Just take 5 minutes, because that 5 minutes could change that person's, you know, they might just be looking for somebody, they might be feeling trapped, that they couldn't speak to you, you know. But if you see a friend that's down, you take 2 minutes, or 2 minutes and lifting the phone, if you think they were a wee bit quiet the last time you spoke to them, just lift the phone, give them a wee phone. It's like Alec, knowing that we were moving here, he moved from the islands when he was young, with his father, you know, he's been there for 40 odd years, but he left the phone, he knew what it was like moving. He knew the challenges and that. Just phoning, I mean, he's not on the phone for hours. He might only be on the phone for 2 minutes, a minute. We phone him, we check in, how are you getting on? It was quite comforting. And if you can do that and return for somebody else and keep somebody else on the right track, it's wee things that raise the mental well-being. It's not having a great big change. I'm going to go and take a gym membership. It all comes down to the individual. And if you can find something that just brings a wee bit more positivity and you raise that factor from a 5 to a 6 or a 6 to a 7, and then you keep going and you go, right, that's really working, I'll keep doing that, what else could I do? Everybody's going to have bad days. You're going to go out there at lambing time and there's going to be a real bad day and it's pissing with rain and you've got a few dead lambs, and or you might have a cow that's choked a calf, and them days are always going to be dreadful. It's how you recover from it.
Well, you're sitting at a 7, so I hope it only goes up from there. What a lovely way to round off the podcast, Callum. Thank you very much for your time. What I'm taking away is that we could all do with an Alec.
Aye.
So a big shout out to all the Alecs out there.
Don't boost his ego too much. He'll not get in the door.
Thank you very much for your time, Callum. And we wish you all the best.
Thank you very much for having me. It's greatly appreciated.
We hope you enjoyed today's blether and it has provided some inspiration for your own well-being. One small step can make a big impact. Find something that works for you. To read our latest stories and news, download our resources and tools, or connect with FarmStrong Scotland, visit our website, allthews.farmstrongscotland.org.uk, or follow us on social media.